You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Robert Taplin. Robert is a sculptor working in New Haven. He's exhibited throughout the United States. He's executed numerous public commissions. And he's also the winner of, among other awards, the Guggenheim Fellowship. Robert, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here, Brainerd.
So, Robert, to begin with, tell us a little bit about what's happening in your studio now. What are you working on or preparing for or just plain doing in your studio?
Right. Well, I just finished up doing a bunch of work on a piece that was done originally for the Aldrich Museum and then was down in the show in New Jersey and has been purchased by a museum up here, the New Britain Museum of American Art. So it's a nice big, 8-foot tall fiberglass piece with internal lighting in this Punchinello series that I've been doing. So it's the young Punch goes shopping with his mother. So it's a large pair of figures on a sort of faux pedestal with internal lighting. So that had a whole lot of work that had to be done on it, and that was recently installed. And then I'm doing some new work, pursuing some of these older series and starting a couple of new things.
And what kind of new work are you involved in now? What does that mean?
The pieces I'm working on right this moment are things called ghost boxes. And they are a small theatrical setup. I've done a bunch of things that have a theatrical aspect to them, or a diorama in effect. So these look like a little miniature movie theater up on legs. So it's maybe, 6 feet tall, 2 feet deep, foot and a half wide. But it's the box itself is just a little sort of proscenium theater. And you look in there and you see something that looks sort of like a movie screen, but it's actually made up of two images, one that's coming down through the roof of the box and one that's in the rear of the box. And they're being combined by a 45-degree angle half-silvered mirror. So you're seeing a reflection that lays on top of a real object, but you can't really tell which is which. They mix up at the same optical distance.
That sounds like a little bit of a departure for you. I mean, it sounds fascinating. It sounds different than probably the work you're preparing for the New Britain Museum.
Yeah, well, the last big show I had in New York was a set of 9 dioramas. So they were big theatrical pieces with internal lighting and figures. They were called Everything Imagined is Real after Dante. They were a set of 5, sort of theatrical dioramas that were worked up over some material from Dante's Inferno. So I've done a lot of theatrical things. These are pressing the illusionary part of it a little harder. It's kind of a trick. It's an old-fashioned 19th century trick, something that you see in natural history museums and something. It's not technical. It doesn't have any, doesn't plug in, but it, it's a thing that looks almost like a hologram. It's a ghost image, a sort of transparent image.
It sounds beautiful, and it sounds also like a slightly different role of light. I mean, I look at your work and I think there's this very unusual role of light in sculpture and within sculpture. And it seems to have, to me at least, formal interest as well as kind of metaphorical allusions to a whole variety of things,
Yeah.
a light within, illumination.
Yeah, for sure.
In this case, you're using it in, again, you're using this kind of light, and it's also using light as a kind of, like you're saying, and almost it's almost a trick, the illusion.
Right.
How do you see the role of light now playing in these?
Well, sure. I mean, the fascination with these things is that you're almost the image that's coming down from above is either a transparent relief, In other words, it's a relief cast in resin with light coming through it, or a photograph that I've messed with. And so there's this possibility of actually sort of drawing in space with the light. In other words, this luminous image seems to just hover out there in space. And then, as I say, it kind of lays over. In fact, the three-dimensional image appears to penetrate the plane, the visual plane of the image that's coming down from above. So the three-dimensional things seem to go through the screen of the other image. So it's pressing. As you said, these other ways I've used light have to do with, you know, a lot of internal illumination of an object that takes what seems like a solid thing and turns it into a skin, a big sign, a thing that's obviously hollow and you know, emanating light from within. And then these dioramas where they were lit like an opera set, you know, theatrical lighting. This is a little different. Yeah, it's something where the image itself is light, but it is, as I say, it floats in the space of the box. So it has a different role. It's harder to grasp.
Right, and it sounds gorgeous, but it also sounds, you know, very real in the sense that we imagine ghosts, spirits, specters, phantoms, you know, these are all sort of a little bit what even a hologram looks like. And
right.
It has literary references as
right.
well.
Right, well,
as,
it's fantastic in
right.
the sense that it's highly imaginary. Yeah, and so in this case, I'm sort of crossbreeding imagery that is indeed sort of fantastic with imagery that's very kind of banal. So the two, in the two cases so far, the image that's coming down from above is very banal. It's a street scene or a sort of a brown field or something. And the image
right.
that's going through is kind of mythical and fantastic. There, it's in fact, I'm using the old myth of Actaeon, who is the guy who goes hunting and he sees the goddess Diana, the goddess of hunting, you know, in the woods taking a bath, and she's naked and he sees her, and she looks at him and says, "You're toast," and he turns him into a deer and his own hounds, his own dogs chase him down and tear him apart. So there's this mythic depiction going on inside this banal, you know, quotidian daily kind of scene.
So in that sense, it is what you shouldn't be looking at. It's what you should.
Right. Right, exactly. Well, that's a very good point, and that's sort of a big theme. That's a big part of the Punchinello series, too. You're often looking, Punch is doing something that you don't really want to look at. You know, one of the big pieces that was down in New Jersey was Punch is homeless. He's pushing a great big shopping cart full of all his stuff, and he's 8 feet tall. And yeah, as you say, the homeless are something we don't want to look at. But he's hard to avoid since he's 8 feet tall and he's white.
Right. You know, it's fascinating because I think the role of the artist, the kind of quintessential role of the artist, is to show us things that we normally wouldn't look at, or it's certainly one of the roles to bring certain things to light, so to speak, that we don't normally see during our
right.
experience
it's,
in the world.
It's a possible role, right? Exactly.
Hmm.
It's, you know, it's not art as a comfortable armchair. I mean, I love Matisse, but that's a different idea. Although, of course, Matisse was giving you the armchair in a way you'd never thought of getting into it or whatever. You know, I mean, the surprise there was the way the image was rendered, the way it was given to you, even though it seemed, you know, comfortable and alluring. Some of the
right.
things I do, the image itself is not comfortable or alluring, even though the way it's presented often is. So it's almost opposite.
Well, that's what you know, is I think important about perhaps cultural literacy or sensibility that artists bring is, you know, normally we wouldn't want to look at things that artists are talking about, but there's a visual seduction that's allowing, I suppose, the participant to get involved with something that they would not normally get involved in.
Right. Yeah.
So let's move back a little bit. What was the first childhood or later? How did you get interested in art? Do you remember your first spark?
I'm a lifer. I'm one of those, you know, kids that, you know, did it right from the beginning, go down to the museum on Saturday and, you know, when you're a little kid and sit there and draw the knights in armor in the armor hall and that kind of thing. And I mean, it's totally ridiculous, but my mother used to tell me that we actually did have a sort of a drainage creek in back of our house when we were right living in the suburbs. We were on the country or anything, but I do remember there was a clay bank in the drainage creek, and we used to go out and dig out the clay. And my mother said, "Oh yeah, I used to go dig out the clay and make these little figures out of it." I was completely astonished, and I don't really remember this, but it's one of those, you know, sort of ridiculous mythic stories, but I can believe it. We did love to mess around back there.
And where was that? Where did you grow up?
Cleveland, Ohio.
Cleveland, Ohio. And so then what happened after that? What was high school, or how did you get involved?
Went off to prep school and had a wonderful sculpture professor in prep school named Cabot Lyford, who, you know, pretty much just set me loose. So, you know, I sort of took every sculpture class they had, and then he just sort of let me go and supported me and kept me from getting kicked out and, you know, those kinds of things. he was my lifeline. And then went off to college in California, Pomona College.
You went to college for fine arts?
I didn't know. Everybody was telling me, oh, you should go to RISD or art school, and I was kind of resistant to the idea because I was interested in other things as well, literature and history and whatnot. So, I went to Pomona College, and I majored in medieval studies and did a lot of stage design. I'd done quite a bit of stage design in high school, actually. I continued to do that out west. This is the early 70s, you know, 69 to 73, so the art environment was very sort of dominated by the sort of coming light and space guys. Jim Terrell was actually around Pomona a lot. He was a recent graduate at that point. Scott Burton was a recent graduate of Pomona. So that was sort of the ambiance of the art world in Los Angeles, and I was not... I liked what Terrell did, but I was not taken with it, and I didn't really do a lot of art in college. Went and saw a lot of art. John Coplins was running the Pasadena Art Museum at that point. It was just spectacular. You know, he did the first big Warhol show and the first big Stella show, and so we saw a lot of great stuff, but wasn't making a lot of art.
It wasn't your major as well. So that
No, medieval studies, yeah. Yeah, studying a lot, you know, art history. I mean, that's where I read Dante. So I was interested in a sort of broader background. It's unusual. There are a few other artists on the scene who have, you know, Leslie Dill has a similar background, for instance. She did literature and whatnot in college, which, of course, wouldn't surprise you a bit looking at her art. But it's a small group, and we're sort of outliers. You know, the literary is not has been a negative quality as far as, you know, modern art was concerned. You know, the modernists hated the literary, and the postmodernists have been a little ambivalent about it. But the background in literature and art and art history and stuff is a little different.
And then graduate school?
Didn't go. Yeah, no. Decided to just set up a studio and got to work. We moved to New Haven because my wife got a job here, And I went over and looked at Yale and considered applying, but a combination of sort of, fear and stubbornness, I never even applied. I also, you know, I had a couple of good hits early on there. I did a project with a friend of mine named Nine Views of New Haven. Daniel Wolf and I did this, and it was sort of a big hit, and it was written up in the New York Times and everything, and I sort of thought, I don't need art school. I was probably wrong, Brainerd, but I didn't go.
Well, maybe you weren't wrong. I just interviewed the critic Dave Hickey, and he said MFA programs should be abolished.
Oh, yeah. Hickey's
nothing but
deeply opposed
work.
To art school.
So when did you get your first show then? So now you're in New Haven. You're out of school.
That exhibition, The Nine Views of New Haven, was in 1977, so 4 years out of school. It was a public thing. They were nine hand-cranked kinetic peep shows that told a story, a sort of ballad about New Haven, and they were hung on light poles and whatnot around all through New Haven. They were, you know, they were outside for a month.
So your first show was a public art, actually.
Was public, yeah, absolutely. And then the Public Art Fund picked it up, and we showed the nine viewers all together in the south end of Union Square in 78, I believe it was. And that was there for a month, and all that was also a hit. You know, it was a voice choice and whatnot, and was very busy, and, you know, it was. This was sort of the era of street art and whatnot, you know, the beginnings of street art. So there was kind of a place for it. It was a pretty unusual project. Nobody, you know, we were told these things wouldn't last a minute on the street. I mean, this was New York in 1978, but they did. I mean, I had to fix them a lot, but people loved them.
Well, that's a very unusual way also to enter into the art world. People occasionally have, you know, a group show or maybe they put together something, but you're entering in the realm of public art, which is, and also as someone who's not an art student or a grad student, that must
right.
have been, that's pretty exciting. And
it was.
Happened?
It didn't really go anywhere, or I didn't know how to make it go anywhere. I was at the time when I did that project with Daniel, I was on my own, this, you know, that project was narrative and figurative and all the rest. The stuff I was doing on my own was, constructivism. It looked like, I was sort of a throwback. I was interested in De Souvre and Ricci and Calder and stuff. And so by 1974, 5, 6, that was pretty out of date. I'm actually going to give a lecture at the Studio School on December 3rd, which I'm going to try and talk about this, because I see it as this sort of conflict between the sort of rationalist tradition of modern art, constructivism, abstraction, etc., and the romantic tradition, which is, you know, figurative, illusionary, narrative, etc. And, I think it's a conflict. It was a conflict in my own work, and it's a conflict in the art world in general.
Absolutely. So now it's the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s. You're still living in New Haven, and you're doing other jobs to support yourself, I imagine?
Yeah, I was, working, doing some welding, working in some of the local theaters, the Long Wharf, doing set work and this kind of thing. And just keeping my head pretty low. I mean, that's kind of why we stayed in New Haven. I had some, desire to get down to New York, but I didn't think we could afford it. And New Haven in the 70s and early 80s was a very depressed city, so everything was incredibly cheap. So we stayed put. You know, I had a studio that cost me $70 a month, and that kind of thing.
Right. And so then, how did that progress? What was how did your involvement with the art world grow? You said you didn't know how to kind of expand on those two.
Yeah, it went into a long stall, to be perfectly frank with you, Brainerd. I spent the next. I had some commissions. I did some state commissions, 1% commissions, and this kind of thing. But I was not able to really enter the gallery world. I didn't find my way in for a long, long time. And I also went through a long stretch of evaluation, trying to figure out, really where I was headed. And I, as I say, in retrospect, I see it as this sort of conflict between this, modernist impulse toward a kind of rational, constructivist, open kind of a, abstraction, and this figurative narrative impulse. And the figurative narrative impulse finally eventually won out, but it took a while. And so, it was really years and years before I had any kind of legitimate gallery representation or whatnot in the city.
Because in the meantime, you are familiar with now how to apply to the 1% kind of commissions, and you're at the very least learning about how to secure public art or enter into competitions for public art.
Right.
Yeah. So what was the first gallery show? How did that happen? And what year was it?
Well, let's see. Eventually, I the Five Outer Planets. I was in group shows and had little, was in some exhibitions in the city in galleries, but just nothing really took. I mean, there's some things were sold and whatnot, but nothing really took. I mean, I showed
Louis New York
Roth
City,
at one point. What? Excuse me?
You mean New York City, not New York.
Yeah, in New York. Yeah. But then I suppose it was really I spent 10 years in the 90s writing for Art in America. So I wrote reviews and articles for them, and that really, truly, that was my sort of entry into the art world. I started to, meet people and, voice my opinions. And then I did a project called The Five Outer Planets, which was a big, big endeavor, and was eventually shown at the Zilke Gallery up here in Wesleyan. And it was really after that I started showing with Winston Walker, and those are the people I've been showing with ever since.
And they represent you. That's in New York.
Yeah. I mean, that show, The Five Outer Planets, was at Wesleyan. I mean, the first one of those, I think, was is 2001. And because that was shown down in the Palm Beach ICA, and then the whole show was maybe the next year, and that's when I got the Guggenheim to do that show. And then that whole show went down to Smack Mellon, the alternative space in Brooklyn, maybe the next year. And that's when I started showing with Winston Walker.
So that was kind of your entry into it. Actually, maybe like you're saying, the Art in America reviews were. How did that begin, the writing for Art in America?
Well, I was up here, up here in New Haven, and as I said, feeling I was pretty isolated and pretty cut off, really, from the scene down there in New York. And I was going down to see a lot of art, and I decided to see if I could, write some reviews, and I wrote a review of a Robert Graham show and a review of a, who was it? I can't remember. No, I wrote two reviews, and I sent them to the magazine, to Art in America, and I did know, I had a contact there, somebody who I had known actually in high school, who was now working as an editor down there. And he took a look at them and corrected the spelling errors and showed them Betsy Baker and said, go ahead, give it a try. And so, as I said, I did that for about 10 years, writing reviews and articles. And that was both an introduction to the art world and a way to speak up, for what I was thinking. And it also, frankly, it kind of clarified my own ideas, I suppose, belatedly, because, you know, when you're going to publish, you have to really bear down. You know, you have to really decide what it is you think and what you're saying. And
right.
I was kind of forced to assess art both that I was interested in and that I wasn't interested in, you know, and assess it anyway. You know, I suppose it was my substitute for going to art school, you know, where you have to sort of learn how to develop a kind of objective point of view toward what you're looking at.
I think that's very powerful. I was talking with another artist, Ken Lum, who also began to write. He would write these very long letters to in response to reviews, but in a way it fostered a similar kind of idea. He said, I was trying to figure out what I thought about art, and by writing incredibly long responses,
right.
He said, I decided after a while. And for him,
right.
That was in school too, because he didn't go to art school either. And it was right. A way of thinking about, you know, how
for
do
sure.
we think talk about art.
For sure, for sure. And yeah.
So then we're in the 90s or something. Is that when, was there a time when you stopped taking traditional jobs and were only working in your studio?
Yeah, I was able to sort of, you know, patch it together. I had a little support from my grandfather, who was an insurance man and a wonderful Sunday painter, who wanted to paint like Hopper. And he died before I was born, but eventually I came into a little bit of money from him, which was enough to sort of keep the wolf from the door. And so we sort of, you know, we kind of limped along. My wife was working. We lived real cheap, and we just kind of kept the wolf from the door that way through the 90s. And, yeah, it really wasn't – really wasn't till, you know, after that I started to sell a little bit more work.
And sell more work means through the gallery or in combination with public work? Like, how did you balance that? Because public work seems to be so demanding in a way, whereas...
Very difficult to make any money doing public commissions, you mean. Yeah.
Right, right.
Oh, no, that's absolutely true, because you're very much up against you know, the competitive process forces people to promise probably way more than they ought to in order to get the job. Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, no, it is more private sales and through the gallery. And I've had some wonderful supporters who have bought my work, you know, even before I was involved with the gallery. And, you know, so some of them have continued to be a real support.
And is that, in other words, friends, family, collectors who come to your studio?
Yeah, those are private contacts. Yeah, people who've gotten involved with what I'm doing and have bought, you know, consistently bought work over the years, just supporting what I'm doing. Yeah.
And how do those contacts begin? That's something that a lot of artists wish for. You know, people coming to their studio, regularly supporting their work, which are, in a sense, patrons. How do those relationships build and continue?
Well, I mean, my situation was one in which, you know, not to make too big a, you know, point out of it, but my work doesn't fit very well into the sort of known categories in the contemporary art world. And so the people who have tended to support me are usually have been people who are really outside the art world, who are not, you know, who are not the collectors that the galleries are interested in, the galleries are dealing with. They were people who took an interest in me and what I was doing, for, you know, other reasons. People who were interested in art, but who were not, all that enamored of the art world and the contemporary gallery system as it stands. So, those things happened.
And that was through work that they had seen in shows or public work? Or
It's usually mostly pretty personal contacts.
Hmm.
Yeah, people who found their way to the studio.
Huh. That's fantastic. And today, what's your having shows regularly at your gallery? How is what's your schedule?
Yeah, no, nothing. The next big thing that's scheduled at this point, I'm going to have a show at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in 2015. As I said, my own work is going through a little change, a little transition here. So yeah, as far as the gallery thing goes, that's sort of on hold for the minute. I'm sure that will work out eventually. But yeah, so things are going through a little bit of a transition right now.
So that show in 2015, that didn't come through the gallery? Was that something that came
No,
directly?
That was, again, I had a show at the Aldrich Museum here in Connecticut, and the show at PAFA came about through contacts from that.
Huh. And, yeah. And the Aldrich, how did that come about? Because that's also not...
Well, that's Connecticut. I've been here a long time, Brainerd. I was in a group show at the Aldrich years ago. They know who I am.
Right.
And they eventually commissioned a piece to go outside, go out temporarily outside. Actually, it's the piece that I just sold to the New Britain Museum. The Aldrich originally commissioned that, for a temporary exhibit.
Right. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you and hearing about how things evolved. And there's a lot of not just artists listening to this broadcast, but people involved in the arts in different ways. Many of them are at the beginning of their careers, but many of them are also mid-career artists that are trying to get a foothold somehow and trying to figure out a variety of things. Is there anything?
It's a tough racket, Brainerd. You know that.
It is.
Yeah.
It sure is. Is there anything you want to say to them about that? About that?
Oh, God, yeah. Don't go there. I beat it out of my own children, for God's sake. Neither of them are artists. So, it's a tough racket. I think, unless you... Well, my own point of view is, of course, unless you have sort of your own personal motivation for what you're doing, it's a pretty, pretty tough thing to hang in there over the long term, because the odds are not in your favor in terms of, as you say, getting and finding a toehold and having any kind of a real career. It's a tough world.
So what made you hang in there all this time?
Well, as I said, I think it's really personal motivation. At some point fairly early on, you develop a kind of attitude where these are problems that you set yourself that you're interested in solving. And you get to a point where that's really all you want to do. And there's nowhere else to go. So,
right.
Yeah.
Did you ever want to just give up or dump it? Did you ever come to a crisis like that or no?
I really didn't. It's always been what I wanted to do. And I'm not to say I wasn't, terribly discouraged at times, because everybody, art, the idea that artists just make art for themselves, I think that's ridiculous. It's not true. Of course, it's not true. It's a social endeavor on some level. And so if you're just cannot get exhibited, cannot get what you do exhibited, that's highly frustrating. But I've had more luck with exhibition than I have with sales over the years. But at the end of the day, without sales, you don't go very far in the art world either. So, it's a tough racket any way you look at it.
Robert, thanks so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate your time and this conversation.
All right, Brainerd. Well, thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.